Hi, this is Azimuth World Foundation's podcast, Connecting the Dots. With the help of our guests, we will be connecting the dots between matters of access to public health and safe water and the balance between humankind and nature among indigenous and rural communities.
Hey, hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm Francisco from Azimuth World Foundation, and I'll be your host for today. In a recent episode of our podcast, we had an enlightening conversation with Inupiaq conservation biologist Dr. Victoria Bushman about the role of Arctic Indigenous communities in shaping conservation strategies. Today, we are expanding upon our previous discussion to more deeply explore a decolonizing approach to Arctic research in general. Furthermore, we aim to examine how this approach can be applied within institutional settings at the community level. We are privileged to have not just one, but two highly knowledgeable guests joining us for this episode, Dr. Kena Ulokichokiak and Corina Kagrak-Premer, who are not only sisters, but also collaborators, currently spearheading a groundbreaking guide and newsletter titled Equity in Arctic Research. We strongly encourage our listeners to subscribe, and you will be able to find the link in the episode description. Dr. Kena Ulokichokiak is Assistant Professor of Technical and Scientific Communication at Virginia Tech. Kena is Inupiaq from Northwest Alaska and an enrolled member of the Narvik Native Community. The digital humanities, data analysis, critical race theory, and indigenous knowledges are combined in Kena's research in order to investigate the intersections of identity, science, technology, medicine, colonialism, and culture. Their work sheds light on how the marginalization of underrepresented scholars and communities is often perpetuated in mainstream academic, institutional, and societal practice. Using theory and data, they aim to craft methodologies that empower others to undertake research and engage in social justice work with respect and sensitivity, particularly in the realm of technical communication and other disciplines. Corina Kagrak-Premer, also of Inupiaq descent, hails from the native village of Kotzebue. As a community leader with extensive frontline experience, Corina brings a unique expertise to her work, specializing in bridging traditional indigenous knowledge and values with Western institutional practices to enhance the well-being of native communities, health, and sovereignty. Her advocacy work is driven by the aspiration to contribute to the restoration of Indigenous peoples' inherent connections with their cultures, knowledge, and communities. Notably, Corina played a pivotal role in establishing the Sayakagvik system of care for children, youth, and families in Northwest Alaska. She served as a co-investigator at SAMIT Lab, an innovative academic tribal health partnership affiliated with Harvard Medical School, and held the position of community director for the Delegates Fellowship, a postgraduate program based in Northwest Alaska, supporting the development of the next generation of Indigenous health leaders. Recently, Corina founded Mamik Consulting, dedicated to assisting Indigenous serving organizations in enhancing their initiatives. Kena, Corina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Francisco.
Thank you. So I will start by asking you, Kena, you grew up in Kotzebue and moved to Virginia to pursue your academic work. And Corina, you moved to Kotzebue when you were 18 after other endeavors to work directly with the community there. Can you both tell us a little bit about your two journeys and how they have led you to your current collaboration?
Yeah, I could start. I moved to Kotzebue at 18, just after what would have been high school. And I started working right away at the health organization, just doing like data coordination. There began to do, 35 years of work with our communities, our youth, you know, I raised 20 kids, our kids for 20 years at home. And so I was mostly a grassroots volunteer on different projects, community projects, and took little short-term leadership positions throughout the community. But a few years ago, I worked again at our health organization in a different role, as you mentioned, and began to do academic partnerships and different areas of research. And so that's where I got kind of connected. And you know, sometimes Kena and I would be, we didn't know because we're in different parts of the country, we would be in the same webinar, you know, something, and noticed that we were both there. And over dinner one day, just talked about, well, what do you do? You know, what do you do? Well, this is what I do. And it was astounding how similar our work kind of, you know, came together in such a beautiful way. So we started thinking about collaborating, you know, around that time.
Yeah, Karina and I are, you know, we're sisters, and I guess a lot of family members like talk about their work in their real life, but our family's really close as like, we connect as people, and our, we talk about our kids primarily, we talk about like what we're doing in our lives. So seeing each other in these like webinars and looking at each other in this different way was added like a really welcome and like wonderful aspect to our relationship as sisters. So I grew up, you know, between California and Alaska, and I went to college back in early 90s and dropped out when I started a family. And, you know, I returned home to Kotzebue to have my baby, and then went back to school once my youngest was born. And, you know, ever since then, I've been really living outside of Kotzebue, though I'm home like all the time. But, you know, for me, I've always felt that it was my duty, you know, with this privilege of an education that I have to really benefit our people. When I went to school, you know, I received scholarships from our people, from the Norvik IRA, and then also from a call of trust in Kotzebue. And that really, you know, I had a lot of gratitude for that. And I've always wanted to give back. That's how our mom and our dad, Caleb, raised us. And we just like, you know, to be of service to our people. That's just like a family value that our parents really gave us. So our parents are Glass Iiepwa Pungawi. She's from the Wells family in Norvik, Alaska. And we have a biological father who's passed away. His name is Carl Albert Welm from Germany. But we were also raised by our stepfather and adopted really by our stepfather, Caleb Lumen Pungawi, who's Yupik from Savunga, Alaska. So anyways, back to my story, but like, you know, I just really wanted to give back. And, you know, we started seeing each other and we realized our goals were aligned, Karina and I, you know, like at these webinars. And I asked her if she would partner with me on maybe some research in the community. And she said, no. So it took 2 years to actually get her to finally say yes.
Yeah, she said research, and I turned around and walked away. Research fatigue is real. So, you know, the cool thing was, though, that, you know, of course, as sisters and this family, we trust each other. And as we began talking, you know, I started to realize that this could actually work. And we could, if anybody can make it work, we could make it work, because we do have a extremely high level of communication and vulnerability and trust between us. And also, you know, it was really cool to find out that we're continuing the legacy of our dad, Caleb Pungawi, who was involved in a lot of global and Arctic research as an Indigenous liaison, really. And our mom, also, she was very much an advocate for our people and our needs as the COO of our Native corporation.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that little bit of family history. That was so great. It's interesting because you're collaborating, but you come to research from two different sides. So reflecting on positionality is crucial for comprehending how to engage with and discuss the communities that are central to your work. Could you elaborate on your dual roles, one as an academic operating externally to the community, and the other as a community leader working from within, and how these shape and define your approach?
Well, for me, you know, Hannah here, you know, because I'm not currently living in our region, let alone Alaska, and I haven't been doing that for a while, you know, it would be pretty audacious of me to try and speak for our communities in any, like, about their lived realities and community contexts, you know, in my work. Really, my job is to listen to communities and use the, you know, my ability, the audience I have, the position I have to, like, amplify and highlight community voices. And, you know, because of my status as, like, Dr. Achakyuk, right, like, academics and others can, like, naturally look at me as some sort of an expert, you know, about our people or a spokesperson for our people. And I try to reject that. And, you know, I work really hard to pay close attention to issues of power, privilege, positionality, when it, like, in my work and as an Inupiaq, and to make sure to highlight and amplify community voices like Karina.
Kana has always been so generous, often deferring to myself and others in the community to make sure, to absolutely make sure that, like, the realistic things in the community are upheld and voiced, which it's not often done. And, you know, it's been very helpful for us, I think, to have two people bridging this gap, because, you know, we're essentially hand in hand bridging a gap between the community and academics.
Thank you. And speaking a little bit of that gap precisely, we know that historically Indigenous communities' relationship with academia has been marked by instances of exploitation of Indigenous knowledge, by a lack of inclusion of the communities in research work, and an inability to prioritize community needs in the definition of research goals. How can we address this history respectfully, avoiding trauma as entertainment, and ensuring that authentic representation for communities focusing on the future and not only just on this past?
Well, I mean, it's really, really easy and simple. And that it's just listen to communities, like, period. And sadly, that's a paradigm shift, right? That's like a big shift. And it's something that makes people feel really uncomfortable, because especially academics and institutions, they're used to being in charge and the power. And they think that wisdom and innovation comes from that area, rather than thinking about the community as the true experts about the community and their issues and the land. And so really, you know, we, like, in that paradigm shift that I'm talking about, right, listening to communities, we really just, it's about giving decision-making power in research to communities, so that the work that we do is sustainable because it serves their aspirations, initiatives, and needs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, as I said earlier, I heard research and I turned around and ran the other way. And a lot of that just comes from this historical disruption that's happened between all of the Western structured, you know, business and education and all of these Western ways that came in and just flip-flopped our priorities, our values. It does not or did not accept us as experts. And when we knew we were scientists. I mean, you can't live in an Arctic community without being an expert in many, many things, geographically isolated, the most extremes of weather, survival, living off the land. All of those things require every bit of expertise as as, you know, a Western idea of what you could learn in a book or practice in a research project. We've done, practiced it, and we've, you know, we've had theories, we practiced them, we made them work, and we are experts. And so it's difficult to think about, you know, this, what I call flipping the script with the academic world or even the Western business structured world, even in our community with our own people, because of this idea that we're not experts or we're not teachers or we're not doctors or scientists. And so, but there also can be, which took me a while to understand, and it's still, we're still working through it because it's a difficult process, that there could be a beautiful and harmonious win-win relationship if the partnership is done right. Because, you know, Indigenous communities have critical needs, and, you know, we can't afford that. And we, you know, we need to address these needs, some of them at an expert level, because these are Western constructed issues that we're dealing with. And so, but what if we partnered? What if we partnered and the academic and research world listened to the communities and gave the communities authority and leadership and training? So yeah, it could be a beautiful, harmonious win-win, and that's what we're working on.
Thank you so much. It's good to hear that perspective for that things are not mutually exclusive. And we know that in terms of funding, for example, we know that Polar Research receives generous funding support. But funding can become a space for assimilation practices too. What is your perspective on current funding trends, and what are their implications for Indigenous scholars and Indigenous communities?
Well, you know, we're all witnessing an unprecedented and really well-intentioned changes in the federal funding sector. And, you know, I'm happy to see that for one, because I think that other funders, whether it be even smaller federal funding organizations, should follow suit. And we also are witnessing an unprecedented Indigenous resurgence. You know, we're standing up saying, no, we deserve the voice. We have the information. We are the experts. And it's just a beautiful thing happening. And so honestly, as an Indigenous community member without formal Western education, it's nice to be acknowledged also at this level as an expert in my field and asked to participate. And at the same time, it seems we have a lot of work to do to make funding support realistically accessible to communities. So, you know, I was recently on the NSF Navigating the New Arctic panel to review proposals. And gosh, it was extremely difficult for me. You know, I had probably 2 to 3 full-time positions at an organization that couldn't fill the positions that were necessary to make things run, and also have a family and all these other things going on. And again, we have to live off the land, so there's subsistence. And to be able to, you know, make my brain think in the scientific way of reading these proposals was extremely difficult. And thankfully, you know, some really cool people like a man named Liam was at NSF willing to meet with me to kind of debrief my experience on this panel. And, you know, my comments were received really well. And, you know, thankfully, I also said, there is no way a community can apply for this and get it. There's just really no way. And it was cool to have them kind of listen to that and think, maybe there's a way we can offer something that the communities would be able to get. And then anyway, in the private funders area, though, you know, they've been way more accessible to communities to be funded. From the ones that I've seen, a lot of them are capital projects, and the social needs that we have require workers. They require people that you hire rather than, you know, a thing that you can buy. And so that's another adjustment, I think, that if, you know, a private funder needs, it would be really helpful to be able to fund, you know, these other types of projects like traditional and cultural education and, you know, those types of things that don't necessarily need a bunch of capital money. So in my opinion, though, also that the private funders, I haven't seen as big of a push to change their internal measures to address colonial and Western assumptions about how funding should work.
Yeah. I mean, private funders, you know, I guess in changing those policies that Karina talked about, right, like talks about was like that are colonial, like practices that don't necessarily work well or mesh well or translate well to like community realities and also value systems, like those changes that are necessary are much more easily done than in the federal sector. So, right, like the you know, philanthropic funders can hear from communities that like, for example, their reporting policies are causing issues, or that using things like SMART goals, quote unquote, SMART goals, really are leaving out community realities, such as their value system, also like how time works and like the realities of like and constraints related to how timing happens in Indigenous communities. But federal funding, like Karina was saying, is really shifting, right? They're shifting in what I agree is like well-intentioned way, you know. In my opinion, National Science Foundation, their Office of Polar Programs is where it's at right now when it comes to modeling equity. They are really setting the trend in doing that. And they're doing cool work really in meeting Indigenous community concerns, but like how the concerns are really being incorporated into federal funding policies and realities. Like what Karina was saying is like, yeah, they want to have more Indigenous participation in research, but could a fully Indigenous organizational like proposal, like can they be competitive in the federal funding space? Maybe not, right? That's like a huge shift that takes like a big shift in who reviews proposals, which is academia, which likes to reify academia as the expert. So it's kind of this like circle, right? And you know, at National Science Foundation and other organizations as well in the federal space, you know, there's a lot of work to change those policies. And the things that they're trying to do, there's like good intentions, but what they're doing, like what happens is, you know, it's kind of clumsy also when it comes to Indigenous communities, because oftentimes they use a pan-Indigenous approach and they, you know, the differences in how Indigenous communities function and work in the lower 48 versus Alaska, for example, are very, very different. But federal policies are like literally currently rolling out right now in response to executive orders and different things like that don't really account for those nuances very well.
Thank you so much. Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of your projects together. And I know your another project that you've been collaborating on is the Rematriation Project, Restoring and Sharing Inuit Knowledges. And can you tell us about this project and how it aims to revitalize community knowledge while avoiding data extractivism? And also, do you believe that new digital communication devices and platforms have the potential to foster self-determination within Indigenous communities?
So the Rematriation Project is a collaboration between Karina over at Movement Consulting and Virginia Tech. So I'm the lead here at Virginia Tech. And really, we're working together to create an online community archive that serves. When I say serves, I mean like that for real, that serves the people of Northwest Alaska. So not only are we working to develop structures that support Inuit, like an Inuit archive that was designed for Inuit users, right? An Inuit archive that's designed for Inuit users versus academic users, but we're also working to grow local capacities in digital archiving itself, so that this archive, this community archive, is replicable in the community, but it's also truly the community's project, because we want to make sure the project is sustainable and that the academic partnership part can like fade away, right? And the community, you know, like is able to really like keep this moving and grow towards community needs. We're just like helping get started. And so to grow those capacities in digital archiving and also like spark interest and growth in the community with these associated skills related to digital archiving. So that includes data literacy, which is really important in protecting Indigenous data and also supporting Indigenous data sovereignty. So that data literacy is, you know, could be as simple as like using data, like using the archive to collect data into a spreadsheet, and then using that spreadsheet to help make decisions, or using, you know, that information to make decisions in community members' roles, but also just to like learn about cool stuff and spark curiosity within our youth and in our community and community pride in our cultural heritage, which would be preserved in this digital community archive.
You know, we purposefully went and started off with the community's need, right? So, you know, my work was kind of sitting over this archive, oral archive of our oral history. And it was like 2,300 files of story upon story upon story upon story of our history and our knowledge and geographical things and subsistence knowledge, how to make tools, you know, how to make a seal scratcher for the ice so that the seal doesn't think it's a polar bear rather than a buddy seal. Those types of things are in there, and we can't even imagine, we don't even know, because they were all in Inupiaq language. And so the younger generations cannot understand them. We don't know our language fluently. So, and our elders who still hold the language, don't have they're older, they're retired, they don't have the physical ability anymore to sit and help us, you know, archive. And we don't have the finances to hire people to do all these things. And so, you know, talking to Kena, I was like, here's the situation. This is something that our people really, really need. We need to get back to our culture, to our language, our ways. This could help so many things that our communities are suffering with, from. And so Kena goes, huh? And so she starts to think about what she can offer and the people that she works with three doors down. So anyways, you know, she was able to find us a team and use her background and her expertise in technical communication and rhetoric to be able to translate back and forth between the technicalities that we don't really understand. So that's kind of how we started off with the rematriation project. And it's grown to now another project called the Coding Project. And that one is to help decode or code the language, the Inupiaq language, training the computer to actually translate for us. And so that was the magic of Dr. Chapiak and her you know, networking skills over yonder, and setting us up with computational linguists, world-renowned computational linguists, and you know, really helping to put those things forward.
And that's the key, right? Is in hearing the community's needs, is you hear the community where they're at, because academics is a little bit siloed. We try to do interdisciplinary work, but it's still decently siloed and project-based. And so trying to think about the problem that the community is posing and translate it into complementary projects with this, and then understanding the skills necessary to get those projects going and to also attract the experts, you know, to use persuasion and whatever it is to get these experts to basically, you know, work for free on these projects for the community. And so that's kind of, you know, I'm not a digital archivist. I'm not a computational linguist. I'm a technical communicator. And so what I do is I help like use communication strategies to help people do their jobs and to work together to meet community needs, goals, and aspirations.
When the community is engaged, when the community, when you can see, you know, equity, justice, all of these things, resurgence, sovereignty being upheld, and they're being a part of doing that because there's a heart behind it now. It's not just a scientific or academic project, right? It's something that is actually going to be helping the community. We purposefully didn't go for big grants in the beginning because we wanted to do it our own way. And we wanted to maintain this like purity of doing it in a way that actually works and actually we don't have to check mark the criteria for the grant, you know, making sure that we're complying with the grant. Because when you do that, then you skew your project to the grant rather than just maintaining the purity of what you really need to do to help the people.
Yeah, it's incredible to learn that the project is developing this way. Your work together strongly advocates that Indigenous communities must be given an equal chance to weigh in on what research is done on their Indigenous land. It also stresses the need to conduct research according to the community's needs, values, and knowledge systems, like we have just been discussing. Are there still many gaps between intentions to carry out equitable research and the way research projects are actually being designed and implemented on the ground?
Of course. You know, there were layers and layers and layers of jumbled up issues created by colonialism over the last century for many, many Indigenous people and communities. There's a lot to work through. And I feel like we're now just realizing that this needs to happen. And as a community member who has been like eyes opened, right? I can see, you know, things like structural racism and psychological oppression and all of these things. I can see it now that I know. And it's very difficult for me as a community member to even bring these topics up to a place where even our organizations or even the people are realizing it themselves or admitting it or taking responsibility for, or, you know, all of those things. So even at the community level, there's so much work to be done.
You know, I wound up writing this Equitable Arctic Research Guide, mm-hmm. and self-publishing it. You know, it's just like a 12-page guide. I actually got it peer-reviewed by colleagues and Indigenous community members, and like just to make sure what I was saying is like, you know, not out there, about, you know, outlining 10 strategies towards equitable Arctic research. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure where that was going, but what resulted is, you know, in having a newsletter and then Karina joining the newsletter. And it's like, you know, over, you know, we started that in March. So getting close to, you know, March 2023. And, you know, over that time, we've still been doing our community engaged research, and we've been writing together as an academic and community partnership and really going through the paces and applying for NSF granting and seeking philanthropic grants and doing all these things to support these projects that we were just describing, and feeling the growing pains of that, like feeling what that really was like. And, you know, Karina was saying that our relationship supports that work quite a bit, because no matter what, like, Karina and I love each other. We're sisters. Like, Karina used to carry me on her back. I was her baby, you know, and, you know, we know we have that background with each other, and we have, like, fought like each other, you know, like we've gotten in fights in this capacity and worked really hard to resolve them, because we could trust each other, even though we were angry at the time or didn't agree or whatever it was, you know, feelings. We were able to, like, rely on that relationship that we have to, like, tease out, like, what's really going on here, and have really vulnerable conversations, even cry, you know, like, to each other, you know, about, like, what's really going on in our professional work and how that's impacting both of us. And then, like, after we've experienced those hiccups, right, being able to zoom out and look at, like, how this is actually a symptom of something bigger than just her and I's interaction, but really thinking about how that's an interaction between institutions and communities. And so over that time of really working hard together and working on deep listening to each other, and, like, really, like, combining all our experience that we've had, you know, we wound up developing a course that literally today launches, like, mm-hmm. It launched today. And that's the Effective Community Engagement and Equitable Arctic Research course. Like, we get tons of emails and questions about, like, about these specific, you know, how things really specifically work. And so it's been fun to, like, really think about, like, if we were going to show somebody, like, how to, like, at least get started in this way that they could feel confident in, you know, even if they are a seasoned scholar or, you know, like, a graduate student just starting off and trying to start off well, or working within their own power structures in academia, right? And as somebody with less power in the structure, like, how they can still use their power, institutional power, and their positionality to work towards equitable outcomes and equitable engagement with Indigenous communities in the Arctic, especially.
Yes, congratulations on launching the course. I think that's so exciting. I saw it in my email today. I was like, this looks incredible. You were precisely talking about when you were describing your relationship and how you felt, and that led you to looking at these problems more deeply. It has a lot to do with trust, right? And because trust is precisely what has been missing in the relationship between academia and Indigenous communities for a long time. And I was going to ask if you can elaborate on the respectful processes involved in truly understanding a community's needs, and what is involved in rebuilding trust with Indigenous communities in Alaska, both in research and institutional settings.
Well, I always said, you know, I work with Harvard Medical, helping to train doctors. And, you know, one of my first things is, like, how many books did you have to read? How much did you have to learn about medicine or whatever, you know, to get to where you are today? Mm-hmm. Well, you need to read and learn about us as a people. I think that, you know, what needs to happen is really try to find out and understand the people that you're working with, their value systems, the local dynamics of the village or on the ground of how things work. Understanding that summertime and fall time are not a great time to come and extract from us, because no time is a good time to distract from us, but, you know, to, because we're subsisting, we have to survive the rest of the year. So, you know, don't come knocking on our door during that time, unless you're ready to grab an ulu and help us cut fish. Right. And that brings it to another level of relationship. We're relational people. Indigenous people are relational and communal people. We help each other. We're not these siloed families in, you know, white picket fences that drive into a garage and barely wave at your neighbor, right? We know each other. We help each other. We live together. And that should include anyone coming from the outside to who is coming to live with us to do whatever, you know, they're doing. We're relational people. And so we can't keep these separations between, hey, you know, I don't want to know that you're a doctor of whatever it is. I want to know where you're from. I want to know, you know, if you have siblings or if you have children or, you know, what your dog's name is or what kind of fishing you like to do. Like that matters to us before anything else.
Yeah. I mean, like the relationships are super important. And the only way to, you know, build those relationships is to recognize that you're coming into a community as like a person, like what Karina was saying, and that you engaging with the community as people as well, right? And not being just your job description or your CV, because they're not compelling. And so, you know, and really then, right, those relationships are really important in helping you to really listen to communities, because then you are connecting as people, you know, and building your own trust for the community in when you listen to them, and they're building trust in you when you listen, you know what I mean? It's this mutual trust, at least what I've experienced in working in these two academic teams that I work in that are really interdisciplinary and really legitimately are filled with early career scholars that most of us don't have tenure yet, right? So we are in this place of like proving ourselves to our own employer that we should keep our job, and that requires all sorts of like requirements, right? So like they have to trust the community that this project is really going to help them to also maintain and grow in their own career, as much as the community is like, this project is going to help us to maintain and grow in our aspirations and needs. And in order for that really to happen is, you know, in that stretching, is that everybody is working, like stretching themselves to work towards our goals with all our skills combined. Right, we are like coming together as a team. And so like I had to look at my own skill set with an open mind and think about how it pairs with the community's goals, aspirations, and needs. And that really takes a lot of humility work, and you know, and that's not easy, but it's like really needed.
Thank you, Kaina. I think I want to ask you about Indigenous knowledge. And on the one hand, we know that Indigenous knowledge, more and more people are talking about Indigenous knowledge these days, but at the same time, we still see an underrepresentation of Indigenous students. And Kaina, can you tell us more about the ways in which your work attempts to bridge this gap? And a parallel question to Karina, if your involvement with youth leadership programs, can you tell us more about the centrality of lifting people back into leadership?
So, I mean, the only reason I'm in academia, I mean, I went through my PhD and I decided, yeah, I don't want to be a professor. Like that was something that I was like, I wasn't sure. because there's just a lot of things that I find toxic here. And the very things that I found toxic here as a student are some of the barriers of access that Inuit students and other Indigenous students and students from marginalized and underrepresented communities face in academia. So I faced those myself. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to bounce, you know, like thanks to the doctorate. I hope I get a better pay because of it. And I'm gone. But then our mom actually was like, you know, I had these universities offering me jobs. And my mom, like, basically sat me down and was like, look at the resources that you have access to, you know, and you have basically a 6-year contract with these folks as a tenure track professor. Like, how about you reframe academia in your mind as a challenge, basically, to like pour academia's resources right back at our people, like just direct those resources towards our people. And that to me seemed like a great goal. And, you know, I love teaching, turns out, and I love research, turns out, but, you know, the reality is I love my people more. And, you know, my work here at a university, or, you know, I really should say like the work that I choose to do as a scholar is to find ways to meet our people's needs through using university resources, but also through like understanding how academia works and making that like working in my sphere of influence to change like my department, right? To change fellowship programs that I'm involved with, to create pathways towards this goal if people choose it, to give them support that they need, right? To like create a way that this isn't such a harsh place. And so, you know, I work hard to hold space for people in my community to get involved in research or just to get involved in academic practices at all, you know, and just to like demystify it. And then also just to create a path for Inuit students to follow, because I had to kind of make that path myself. And I know how hard it can be.
And I myself, I don't desire to get a degree. I never did. Of course, working, you know, in health organization when I was there, I remember, you know, having a conversation with our team. We were talking about elevating, you know, the voices of the local people and getting a seat at the table and of decision making. And one of the psychologists was saying, you know, well, we just need to encourage them to go to school and get educated. And then, you know, then they'll have the seat at the table and be able to put their voice in. And I said, no. And this was someone who was absolutely amazing, equity minded, all of that. But that was what they really believed, because that's what we've been trained to believe, right? Even we've always been told in the village, go out, get your education, come back and help your people. That's like the thing, right? And, you know, for me, I never desired it. And I'm not going to be thought less than because of that. I am educated, I'm self-educated, and I'm community educated. You know, many of our people only went to high school. I got my GED, yay. But, you know, many of our people only went to high school. Many of them were sent to boarding schools and didn't go any further than that. But boy, they're an expert sled maker, or they know about going out in the country and, you know, what kind of weather, you know, what this cloud in the sky means and why you shouldn't go there to the yellow cloud in the sky, because it's open water. So, yeah, so I feel like, you know, as I help to develop youth programs and raising up leadership, I always want to make sure that it's the wisdom of our people that is education. We have our own educational system in the village. We always have, right? But it's more of an apprenticeship model of education and degrees, that, you know, you graduate. You graduate to be able to cut the fish at a certain age. And then I've been present when, you know, this, you know, young teenager, 11-year-old is going, I can't believe it. I get, this year is my year, you know? And so there's this level of wisdom that happens in a whole different system, a whole different way, that is equal to a Western education system. That needs to be acknowledged in every respect.
Yes, that's amazing. Thank you so much, Corina, for sharing. Well, we've been talking for a while now. Maybe I would ask you, in what ways would you like to see your work being implemented by others in the coming years? And in that sense, also, what is making you hopeful about the future right now?
I'll go. You know, Liam at NSF, a wonderful man who has been a real champion for Indigenous work and in research. He asked a similar question to me at our first meeting together. He said, what do you hope to see? Or what do you hope from all of this? And, you know, I could have said, you know, for my people, for whatever, but I think that we can be a voice to change the systems that affect our people globally. We can be a part of that change. And, you know, for some reason we have this sort of magic that really works in that respect between the, you know, different communities, whether it's the Indigenous to the academia communities. And we're able to do that. And if we can, and we see that there's a bigger reach and a bigger need and globally. And there are many, many of us Indigenous people that are doing this very same thing. And so I just want to be a part of that community and helping to change things for our homes that have many, many needs that aren't necessarily considered in research and academia.
And, you know, for me, in the work that I do, you know, on the academic side and how I, you know, like translate this experience into publications, which are then used as tools for other people to justify whatever change they're advocating for in their own work, right? Like, and I really, like, for me, what would be success for me is that I can retire from this gig of like, hey, can we just do some equity, please, and relating to Indigenous communities? Because this work, literally, our dad was doing this in the 90s, right? Like in the early 90s. It's been a long time that we're asking the same thing. And, you know, Corina and I, like, a lot of our recommendations are just like, to us, really common sense. And so I would love it if, you know, people would engage in doing the work, right, and checking their motivations and realizing that power sharing is actually the key to this innovation in Arctic research, right? Sharing power and hearing about the yellow cloud in the sky means open water, and recognizing that as a scientific observation, right? And the demonstration of scientific expertise. And like the, when someone says, hey, we're interested in XYZ, and the community is like, yeah, we already kind of know what's happening with that. It's probably something about this, to listen to them. But because what they're going to say next is, what we're really interested in is this, because this is something that's come, is creeping up, and we haven't figured out what's coming towards us. Because like in Kotzebue, right, in the Northwest Arctic area and along this coast in Alaska, these frontline communities and are facing climate change right now. And so, you know, academic curiosities aren't saving lives, right? Aren't saving homes, aren't saving lives, like cultural connection and community connection to the land, right? It's not doing that work. And so my goal is, you know, people just to listen, to like do the work, to like get out of their own way, really, towards innovation and working with communities. Like, get out of your own way. And so I can retire and build, do construction, which is really what I want to do, which is like build little houses and furniture and like play in my workshop and wear an apron and not worry about, you know, Dr. So-and-so acting messy. at home. So please, that would make me happy.
Well, I think it's your work really has this powerful message about people just listening to each other, but really actually listening and seeing each other in the most human way. And that's inspiring for everyone, I think, even besides like research and everything. You know, I had a lot of questions, but maybe if there's anything that you didn't cover during this conversation that you still want to share with our audience as a last message.
Well, I would like to say that just in this process of working with you, Francisco, and how you've approached like getting ready for this interview, you've like read a ton of our work, you've like communicated with us really closely. What you are doing right now is demonstrating what we're asking people to do, right? Like you didn't come in like, please tell me about who you are. And like, as if like, it is an honor to meet you, but like that as if you're the cookie, right? When you're asking something of us, and instead you've like invested in understanding like who we are and what we're trying to do. And then checking with us about like, hey, I hear this is what you're trying to do. Do I got it right? Do you feel like that, Karina?
Oh, yes. I want to really thank you for meeting with us today and asking us to be a part of this. And, you know, I know that we all kind of, again, hand in hand work, will work together to create the change that's needed. So I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you so much. It means a lot to hear that. Thank you for such kind words. And just once again, I want to invite our audience to please subscribe to your Arctic, Equitable Arctic Research newsletter to keep following your work. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Connecting the Dots, an Azimuth World Foundation podcast. Join the conversation on our website, azimuthworldfoundation.org, or by following us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn.